My name is Douglas Rubio. I'm here with Rich Huff of Midwest Pinball Restoration. Today is November 9th, and we're going to start with questions.
I'm James Adkins. So, how long have you been in the industry?
15 years. I started in 2001.
Okay. And you've pretty much always been into pinball?
Or nope.
No? What'd you do before then?
I did business consulting.
Okay.
Yeah, growing up, I was more into arcade games. I didn't play pinball.
Okay. And so what got you into
this business? There's a guy that I used to work with in one of my jobs, and he had moved on to a different business. I moved on to a different business. And when we reconnected, he said, "What do you do?" I said, "I do business consulting." "What do you do?" He said, "I buy and sell pinball machines full time." "Well, that's pretty cool.
Nice.
You can make money at that?" He's like, "Oh, yeah." So I went over to his place, and I hung out, and we played a couple of games. And he said, "Well, Rich, if you see anything you like, let me know. I'll get one for you." I said, "Yeah, this one's kind of fun." 2 weeks later, he called me up. He said, "Hey, Rich, I got you a Tales of the Arabian Nights.
Nice.
Let's put it in your basement." And it was about that time that I quit my consulting job. I decided to take the summer off. Mm-hmm. I had been ostensibly hired by an internet startup, but this is 2001. It's at the tail end of that. It wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
So I really had pretty much 4 days a week with nothing to do.
Okay.
And I had complained to him that my game didn't look like his. And he said, "Well, what doesn't work?" Says, "No, it's not that it's not working. It doesn't look like yours. Yours shines." And he said, "Well, Rich, yours is dirty. It's a re-import from Germany. They smoke like chimneys over there. Here's the deal. I got you the game you wanted. I made sure it was working 100%, and I sold it to you at my cost. I didn't put anything into cleaning it up. If you want to learn how to clean it up, you can do that." Like I said, 4 days a week with nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I was over at his place cleaning games, learning how to do mine. And he said, "You know, I get people who call me asking for service. And if they didn't buy the game from me, I'm not interested in servicing their game. My business is buying and selling pinball machines." So I created Midwest Pinball to do service, really. And it ran part-time. I went back into consulting by the end of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
It ran part-time through about 2008. And then in 2008, the consulting business dried up, so I switched it and made Midwest Pinball full-time and did the consulting part-time.
Okay.
And then that disappeared 2 years ago.
Okay. let's see. What would you say was the biggest turning point in the industry that you've seen so far?
That I've seen, I missed most of it, in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Realistically, I would say it was Jersey Jack Pinball.
Okay.
Coming onto the market.
And when did they come on?
2013, I think, is when they announced. Maybe 2012.
Okay.
But, in 1999, Gary Stern bought back his dad's company and started Stern Pinball. He bought it from Sega. That was the same year that Williams, who had bought Bally, basically said, "Hey, we're out of the pinball business. We make slot machines, and we make good money making slot machines. We're switching all of our operations over to slots." That left Stern as the only major manufacturer of pinball machines for over a decade. So from 99, pretty much through 2011, 2012, when Jersey Jack really came onto the market and said, "Hey, we're going to find our own titles and manufacture our own games for commercial use." You know, some people have been manufacturing short runs. They do, you know, a run of 10, or they might do something on the side out of their garage. This was somebody saying, hey, we're going to launch a major manufacturing operation out of New Jersey, and we're competing with Stern.
Nice.
Yeah, and they make gorgeous games.
Awesome. Awesome. What games do they make?
Their first title was Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
It's a very big game. It's got a lot of features, lots of toys. It made it very expensive, but they basically said our market is we're not trying to, you know, undercut Stern. We're going for the high end of the market. That's where we're going to be. Now, since then, there are probably a dozen companies developing pinball machines. They're not all manufacturing them, but they're developing them. Okay. So Stern manufactures, or we could say assembles, their games, mm-hmm. Whizbang, and Chicago Gaming Games, all in their factory. Because both of those organizations looked at what it would cost to set up a factory mm-hmm. and said, gosh, do we really want to drop a couple million bucks in, you know, equipment? Made a deal with Stern. It's like, hey, you guys do the assembly. You know, we ship you all the parts, you do the assembly, you handle the distribution, which they do. Jersey Jack is a partnership with one of the old pinball designers from Bally & Williams. So I think they're doing a similar deal. There's a manufacturer out of Wisconsin, and there's one or two in Europe.
Nice.
But now all of a sudden you've got 12 titles a year coming out. Awesome. And where Stern used to do, they did three for a while, and then it was down to two, then it was one.
Nice.
Very nice. So it's significant growth in the industry.
Yeah.
On the pinball side.
Yeah.
The arcade side has stayed pretty steady. I don't do a whole lot with the arcade stuff.
Okay.
But, you know, the Sega makes Silent Scope, or, you know, whatever the gun games are, the sit-down games that you really find in GameWorks.
Yeah.
GameWorks is owned by Sega.
Okay.
So they manufacture the games, they put them on their locations. You know, they sell them out to other locations through distributors, but they feed their own locations with their games.
Okay. I didn't know that they were owned by Sega.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's how the movie theaters used to work.
Really?
Yeah, the guys that made movies, mm-hmm. you know, in the, what would be, 20s, 30s, probably into the 40s, they owned the theaters.
Nice.
Paramount made the movies, owned the actors. If you were working for Paramount, you didn't work for anybody else. Mm-hmm. They owned the theater. They had the whole chain, basically.
Nice. And we were talking about this offline, but it was what made you get into the industry. Do you want to go back over?
Yeah, it was really you're working with my friend at Perfect Amusements.
Okay. Very nice. So can you give us an idea of the progression through the industry, your progression through the industry? Any highs, any lows?
Well, I essentially started this business bootstrap, which... without money, which is a hard way to do it.
Yeah.
So it has been a very slow progression for, you know, the past mm-hmm. 10 years. Plus, I wasn't doing it full time.
Yeah.
We are only now getting to the point where I mean, we've got a good book of business. I've got a solid customer base. I'm booking work now out into January.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Do you have any, like with the beer cades and all that in the city?
I don't do any commercial work.
Okay.
I only do residential.
Okay. Are there any specific people that have influenced you in this industry? Or?
I'd say that Pat Choi from Endless Pinball. Wait. Perfect Amusements became Endless Pinball.
Okay.
Certainly Pat Choi was a big influence because he's the one who got me started in this. And then you have to admire Gary Stern
yeah.
for sticking with it. For him, it was family, and he, you know, he bought the company back to keep the Stern name on it, which is cool,
yeah.
And to keep pinball alive.
Nice. Do you want to? Okay.
Onward.
Number 7.
Okay, so, what is your favorite game, personally? Or any that gave you, like, a deep personal connection or anything like that?
Well, my favorite game growing up was Gauntlet, which I think is from the mid-80s. It's a four-player arcade game. You play the Elf, Wizard, Barbarian. Valkyrie. What was nice about it was that four people could play at once. So if you went to the arcade with your friends, but you didn't need four player. So if you went to the arcade and you were there by yourself, you could start a game by yourself. If someone else came along, they'd add their quarters and their character would jump in. You play up to four, and if somebody dropped out, you guys could just keep playing. So that was really the one that I liked to go to the arcade to play. And then in terms of pinball machines, I really think Tales of the Arabian Nights is still my favorite.
Nice.
It's a very nice combination of artwork and sound and some decent ball flow.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah, I saw that on the website. Mentioned that game. There was another one also on your website that I saw.
The Spider-Man, yeah. Oh,
okay.
I still have both of them.
Okay, cool.
Spider-Man Black it's a much newer game. Arabian Nights is from 95. That's a classic Williams title.
Okay.
Spider-Man's from 2007, I think. That's a Stern title. It also has good ball flow, but it's, the colors on it are very, it's designed after a comic book character, so it's very, you know, basic comic book colors. Stern has done well with the comic book superhero titles and Rock Bands recently.
Yeah, I actually saw one for Metallica.
They did AC/DC, Metallica, they did Kiss, which Bally had done back in the late 70s. The next one on the list is Aerosmith, at some point in the future, either this year, well, I guess we'd be looking at next year. And then there's rumors of other band titles, too.
Nice.
Oh, that's cool.
And on the superhero side, they did Spider-Man. They did Iron Man. They did Avengers.
So why do you think that CoinApp has stayed so relevant throughout all these years?
I don't know that it has.
Okay.
I mean, it's it was certainly big in the 70s. And strong through the 80s, and it really started to diminish in the 90s. Most of the arcades went away.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a number of people who've posited why that might have happened. There was a movie that came out several years ago called Special When Lit. It was a documentary on pinball. And one of their conclusions was the home arcades. Kids didn't have to go anywhere to play a range of games. They could sit in front of the TV and do it.
Yeah.
And so now what you're seeing is you're seeing a resurgence of the arcades, but they're not for kids. It's barcades. It's for adults. The one exception to that in this area is Galloping Ghost, is out in Brookfield,
mm-hmm.
which is you pay once, you go and you play all day if you want, but there's no alcohol. It's designed for kids.
Yeah.
I think the some of the other locations, even like GameWorks, if you look at GameWorks, once it's like 6 o'clock, or depending on which one you're at, like Schaumburg, I think it's based on the curfew that Schaumburg has, but it's either 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock, they kick out anybody who's under the age of 24. So, you know, because we serve alcohol, and the deal we have with the village is if we're going to serve, all the kids have to be gone. So it's an adult-oriented thing. And that's really because the adults who have the money grew up in the 80s and 70s, further back. That's what they want to do. Yeah. It's because, you know, certainly from a pinball perspective, it's become much more of a home market. And I would guess that to some respects the same as can be said of the arcade side. If you look at gaming systems, Golden Tee, you know, Golden Tee has transitioned from the arcades, which aren't around anymore, into homes. It was strong in bars. I'm sure it's still strong in bars. Yeah. But I see a lot of Golden Tees in homes. I see arcade games in homes. Yes.
If one is interested in the coin-op industry, where should they start?
At a trade show. There's a number of very large trade shows that still run. If you look at the whole industry, typically they're in Vegas. If you look specifically at the pinball industry, there's probably about 10 or 12 every year throughout the U.S. One of the big ones is here in Chicago. It's Pinball Expo, typically in October. And then there's another one that runs twice a year here in Chicago, which is the Coin-Op Show, Chicagoland Coin-Op Show, which is in St. Charles. And that's this weekend.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So we'll be there.
Very nice.
Not a lot of pinball. That's,
yeah.
It's the Coin-Op Show is a lot of jukeboxes, slot machines. There's a couple of pinball vendors. There's some non-coin-op stuff like antique signs. There's some guys that do arcade there, not a whole lot. And there's some guys that do some really very interesting coin-op stuff. I think Chicago Coin used to make units that were little four-person bandstands with marionettes. So the you start the song, curtains open up, the players start playing their instruments.
Nice.
It's big.
And how do you think Chicago is different, the coin-op industry here, compared to other places in the country?
I think it comes down to the history. I mean, if you go back to the 20s or 30s, there were hundreds of pinball manufacturers here in Chicago. It was a huge industry, and I'm sure a lot of that just came about from rail lines and the ability to move product and the industrialization. Chicago was a good place to start a business. So we still live off that legacy. I survive off that legacy. I mean, I get somewhere between 200 and 250 new customers every year. That's people who call me up and say, hey, I've got a game in my house that needs service. And very often I hear, well, my uncle used to work for Bally, not in their sales department. He was in their accounting department or something, but Bally would finish with a game. They might have a couple left over. Employees could buy them, take them home. So lots of home use stuff in Chicago. It's there because it was all built here. Nice. And in general, the way the pinball industry worked is is they would run at one title once, and then they'd move on to whatever was next. So you up until recently, you wouldn't get a title, even if it was a popular title, made once, and then a couple of years later make it again, a couple of years later make it again. What they would do in that case is they would take a popular title, they'd create a new title that might be like a sequel or a remake of it, and produce that with the latest sound and lights and whatnot. So a lot of these older games are sitting in houses in Chicago.
So, what would you say is the most common thing you do when restoring a machine? Or what's usually, like, the part that you have to fix? Or is it always different?
It's usually different. I mean, if it comes down to it, it's most often the rubber bands. You know, a lot of time we're working on games that have been sitting or haven't been serviced in many years, and the rubber bands are dry rotted. If it's a newer game, which means if it was made after 78, it's got batteries in it. So, especially through the 80s and 90s, you know, as these games moved from a location into a residential environment, people that bought them didn't realize there were batteries in them. And then all of a sudden, their game just stops working, and it's because the batteries have died. And they're leaking acid into the CPU.
Nice.
Yeah. So we try and do an announcement on our website and through our blog and on Facebook every October when they do the PSAs about changing the batteries in your smoke detector. Mm-hmm. We say, hey, remember to check or change the batteries in your pinball machine if it's got them, if it's a modern game.
So they don't just run off AC, and they don't have batteries.
They do run off AC, but what they have the batteries for is to save what are called non-factory settings. So high scores, free play is typically a non-factory setting. Mm-hmm. Most of the games coming out of the factory were set up for coins. The older electromechanical games didn't save high scores. They saved nothing. So you could turn it off, turn it on, you could unplug it, you could move it, you could throw it in storage for 20 years, pull it back out, turn it back on. You know, it's all relays. It has no memory. Mm-hmm. The newer games have memory, and to hold that without the AC, you need the batteries of some sort or a capacitor. Okay.
So what do you think goes into a good coin-op game?
It really comes down to the gameplay. Artwork is great, sounds are great. It really comes down to the gameplay, and there's a science to that, which I can appreciate but don't understand. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The first, the one that everybody thinks of. When they on a, the pinball perspective, is Addams Family. Addams Family is a great game, whether you care about the characters or not. It's essentially the perfect storm of gameplay, features, sound/music, and artwork. It works. Everything works. Everything. It draws in people who have never played pinball before. Because it's fun, it's a little unpredictable, but not too unpredictable, because it's got magnets under the playfield. It's a great game. The team that made that was the Bally team. After Williams had bought Bally, they kept the design team, so they had two design teams. They said, okay, here's your project, Addams Family. And they did such a good job that Williams was like, oh my gosh, you guys are awesome. We made more Addams Families than any other pinball machine ever made. So we're going to let you pick your next project. Twilight Zone. We want to do Twilight Zone. And You know, this is the designer saying, we're telling you right now it's going to be expensive because you have to get the license from Paramount. If we want Rod Serling on there, you have to get the license for his image from his estate. It's a wide body. There's a lot of stuff going on. Williams pretty much said, fine, whatever you want. Do it. We love you guys. And while today it's a very popular game in the home environment, from a commercial perspective, it wasn't a big hit. And they were, you know, Williams was kind of confused. They're like, hey, you did really well on this one and not so good on this one. What's up? And this is from a talk the designer gave. He said, basically, we made a pinball machine for pinball players. It's big, it's deep, it's complicated. The typical guy in a bar putting his 50 cents in is going to get lost really quickly. There's too much stuff going on. It's not always well called out as to what to do next. He just doesn't know. He's not going to put his money in again. Hence, it's not going to do well on location. It's not going to do well commercially. But if you've got it in your home and you've got the time to play on it and understand it, it's a deep, complicated game. It's a lot of fun. There was a game that I picked up at one point for resale from a company called Game Plan. And Game Plan was around for a handful of years. They made some, I don't know how many titles they made, maybe 10 or 12. The game was really boring. And if you put it next to a Bally game from the same year and just looked at it and said, okay, Game Plan game has two flippers, Bally game has two flippers. Game Plan game has three pop bumpers, Bally game has three pop bumpers. This one has drop targets, this one has drop targets. This one has stand-ups, this one has stand-ups. It's all the same stuff. Why is it that this one is no fun to play? And that's where the science of gameplay comes in. And like I said, I don't understand it, but I can recognize it. I recognize it's a pretty boring game. The guys that understand it do well. Roger Sharp, who if you spend any time in this industry, you're going to come across his name. He's a pinball designer, and my understanding reading interviews that he did was sometimes the companies would call him in to tweak the designs of games. And he would come and he would look at the playfield, they would look at the rule set, and he would say, hey, you know what? You need to take this switch here that scores 10,000 points and move it over here to this side of the playfield. Because this shot is too easy to get. If you make it this shot, then the player feels that he's actually earned that 10,000 points. That level of ball play, like I said, I can't do it, but I understand enough to appreciate it. That's what makes a game a great game. He is in the Chicago area, as are his sons, so I would, if you're looking for interviews, I would see if you can find him if you haven't already.
Cool.
He wrote a book on pinball in the 70s, and when the legality of pinball came to the Supreme Court in the mid to late 70s, I think it was 76, there was a disagreement as to whether or not pinball was gambling. It had been classified as gambling for a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. So the city of New York said you cannot have pinball machines in the city. They're gambling devices. And gambling is regulated. And the pinball manufacturers wanted to prove that it wasn't. And they fought it all the way up to the New York Supreme Court. And they basically called in Roger Sharp. And they put a game in the courtroom. And they had people from the jury basically ask him to make a shot. Well, can you hit that? And he could hit it. Can you hit that? And he could hit it. Proving that it's a game of skill, not a game of chance.
Okay. You mentioned the two games, Addams Family and Twilight Zone. So which one do you like better?
Between those two?
Yeah.
I like Addams Family better. Twilight Zone really is big and complicated. Adams Family's. Plus, Adams Family has that weird sense of humor to it that you get from the theme mm-hmm. that I enjoy.
Okay. In terms of Pinball Machine, you say gameplay is really important, right? It's not just, you know, hitting the buttons or whatever. So what do you like when you play a pinball machine? What do you like in terms of gameplay? What do you look like? What do you look for in a game in a good pinball game?
In general, you're looking for, what I'm looking for is a mix of shots, meaning that what you're shooting for on the play field ranges between mid and long range shots. It's tough to design a short range shot because the flippers, if they're going to drive the ball back here, you're going to have a real hard time having the flipper try and shoot at something that's right here. So if you start about mid play field back and provide a range of shots, a good example of that is Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings has essentially a shot map of like seven shots that go as rays across the playfield. And it's the Shire. There's a loop. There's a quick turn ramp that feeds back into the return lane. There's a shot up towards the back that has the basically would feed into the lanes. There's a jump ramp, which has the Balrog in front of it sometimes. There's the Gollum hole. There's the other end of the loop. And then there's the stand-up targets over here. So you've got all those shots. Other games that have stuff too tight to the middle of the playfield, tend to cut off a lot of the ball flow. You see that more in a game, some of the older games from the 60s, but we'll tend to have more mid-range shots. Quite honestly, that's because the games have 2-inch flippers as opposed to the 3-inch flippers. You can't quite get the momentum off a 2-inch flipper to keep driving the ball all the way back to the back of the game. Tales of the Arabian Nights has a nice range of shots. It also has a spinning lamp kind of right in the middle of the play field, which does kind of hinder some of those shots. Some people find that game to be too easy. I don't know. I like it.
Nice. Are there any recent innovations in coin-op that have helped the industry, do you think?
Again, just from the pinball perspective, yeah. Basically, the display, your score display, has transitioned over the years from a series of lights to score wheels to numeric displays that show your score to alphanumeric displays where they can put messages and your score to dot matrix displays, which allow for better animation in between showing the scores. One of the things that Williams did, in fact, just before they shut down, was they integrated video into their pinball machines. So the last two games that they produced had a monitor that was would display everything in reverse because it was reflected off the glass. So you could look at the glass. The glass was polarized to allow for the reflection. So the animation was 100%. It could change what you were shooting at. It could essentially hide that whole upper play field to make it look different for every scenario. It just didn't take off. And part of it is because Williams just stopped doing pinball right then. When Jersey Jack came out with Wizard of Oz, one of the big things that they did was they put a flat screen LCD panel into the back. So for Wizard of Oz, not only do you get score displays and animation, you get full color video clips with sound. You know, it really changes the experience for the player. There's a lot more to look at on the back box now. They did that with their next couple of games, and it looks like the other manufacturers are starting to incorporate that as well.
Very cool.
And I think part of that is that those dot matrix displays, the dot matrix displays really limit what you can show, because the resolution on the dot matrix display is very low. So you're dealing with dots that you can visually see. You can visually pick out the dots. You get to an LCD panel, you don't see the dots. You see the motion. You see whatever it is they're showing you. It's really cool. That's one innovation that has come out recently. Just within the past year, they've introduced holograms. So they can actually project holograms that you can target and shoot at on the playfield. The new title from Jersey Jack, and this is basically from the designer that did Addams Family and Twilight Zone, Pat Lawler, his latest game through Jersey Jack is called Dialed In. It integrates with your smartphone.
Nice.
So all of a sudden, it's a whole different element to the user experience. It's got a camera in it. It's got a wide range of things. I have not had a chance to actually play it, so I don't know how it integrates. And I'd say it's through development. They're probably starting production on it.
I'm interested to see how the phone plays a part in that.
Yeah, I've got a flyer for it around here somewhere. I can give you.
Nice.
Do any of them use the internet for like uploading high scores, anything like that?
They have a tournament mode, and I'm not sure how that works because, again, I don't run across it because I don't do commercial work. I know that on the slot machine side, interconnectivity between the devices has been a very popular theme. That's where everybody makes their money. Because basically, you're no longer just trying to get the high score for that unit. You're trying to get scores as compared to the whole production run of units that are in operation. They're all interconnected. The manufacturer gets a cut of that. It's one of the things that's made Williams a lot of money the past 10 years.
Very cool.
So, how do you figure pricing for your games?
For my games or for my service?
For the games.
There is, for the pinball machines, there is a book value. It's the Mr. Pinball Price Guide. We use that. That is essentially like a wholesale value. So if you're buying a game on Craigslist and it meets the description of works 100% in pretty good shape, that gives you kind of the wholesale price. We typically go anywhere from 50 to 100% above that, because the games that we sell are typically beyond pretty good shape. They're in very good shape. They are working 100%. We have upgraded them as needed with LED lighting, any of the additional modifications, new hardware where needed, and then we back it all with a 60-day parts and service warranty. So,
okay.
In terms of where that falls out, a lot of it tends to do with the market. There are games from the 70s that fully restored will sell for $3,000, $4,000, and you're looking at it, and you're like, the game that company made next could be a $300 game. It's just there's something about that title. It's extremely popular, so it's worth it to put a lot of money into making it look perfect. Mm-hmm. Some games it's not. You know, I went down last week to a guy was. He's moving to Florida because he's retiring. He was trying to sell his game. And his game had been in the garage for several years and had occupants at one point. And I'm like, I don't want it. He's like, well, just make me an offer. I'm like, no, I don't want it. I mean, even for $100, I'm going to drag this thing home, put it in my storage unit where it's going to sit for at least a year before I can get to it. And then I'm going to have to spend $400 maybe to get up to the point where I could sell it. So I paid you $100. I moved it. That's $100. I put another $400. That's $600. The best I can sell this title for is maybe $600. Mm-hmm. I haven't made any money. So yeah, you always have to kind of factor in. If you're selling it, are you making money on it or not?
You mentioned Craigslist. When you go out look for games, what about eBay?
I don't look for games. People find me.
Okay.
I've spent a lot of money on my website, and I spend a good chunk of money every month for somebody to run search engine optimization, which I kind of understand. Again, I don't need to understand it. I pay someone to do it for me. Mm-hmm. My website basically pulls in more business than I can handle right now.
Nice.
So if you're in Chicago and you do a search on Chicago pinball, pinball repair, pinballs for sale, pinball restoration, if you think of the term restoration, chances are I'm going to be in the top 3, 5, or at least on the top page on all of those searches. So when you've got a pinball machine to sell because the kids have moved out or, unfortunately someone passed away and now you're clearing out the house, they find my site. They call me up and they say, we have a pinball machine, are you interested? And I can pick and choose whether I'm interested in the game. Okay. The Craigslist is a little iffy. Because you're fighting with everybody. There's easy enough ways to search all of Craigslist nationwide, four times a day. You do it once in the morning, once in the afternoon, once at night, whenever. And the moment you spot something that's really a deal, you pick it up. I don't have that kind of time. I spend most of my days out on service calls. And then when I get home, I've got a 3-year-old kid, so I can't be hunting through Craigslist. eBay, I've bought stuff off of eBay before. I don't like it to buy games. Buying parts, especially parts that are hard to find, sure, I don't have a problem with it. Buying anything mechanical where you're relying on the seller to have actually been accurate in his description. Same thing with Craigslist, but generally with Craigslist, you haven't transferred the money until you're actually standing in front of the product.
Yeah.
eBay is a little tougher. And eBay has made it much easier now for the buyers to get their money back. But it's still a hassle. I mean, especially if you're having the game shipped, the game shows up and it's not what you expected, it's in bad shape. Now it's like, all right, well, how much is this going to cost me to send it back?
So when people call you and they ask you if you're interested in their games, has there been any pretty much like a really good find, like you struck, like they had something really good?
Occasionally. Generally they're either they know what it's worth or they don't, and if they know what it's worth, they're getting that information off the internet, and they're probably looking at retail prices, in which case I'm not going to be able to buy it. Because if I can sell the game for $5,000 and they want it for, they want me to pay $4,500 for it, I don't make money. Sorry. I need to pick it up for $2,500 to sell it for $5,000. If they don't know what it's worth, then I can give them the book and I can point them. There is one resource on the web. It's Boston Pinball's website. And the guys there have a heck of a lot of time on their hands because they track every completed pinball machine sale on eBay. They tabulate that data and they put it all out there for everybody to see. So you can go to Boston Pinball, you can type in, you know, Adams Family, and it will basically say the average sale price for Adams Family over the past 7 years has been X. The low was this, the high was this. This is based on N number of sales, and here's the average without the high and low. So there's no real way to qualify for condition, because the condition, each game is unique. Regardless, it's the condition that it's in is based on its history and its environment. But that's why they give you the high and low. Some people call me up and they say, hey, I have such and such a game, what's it worth? I can point them to Boston Pinball. I can say, here's the value according to Boston Pinball. It's based on more than 50 sales, so you can consider that to be an equitable average. If it's based on one sale, that could be really skewed. And then I'll say, this is what I'll pay you based on that. So it's not just me saying, oh, the book value is $1,000, so I'll give you $900, you know, when the book value might be $2,500. I give the seller the opportunity to look at some public source of information. Mm-hmm. I don't do a lot of sales. I mean, if I do sales, it's between now and Christmas is when I sell probably 90% of the games that I'm going to sell in a year. Most of my business is service.
Do you have any specific examples of a game that you acquired recently that's rare or really?
Sure. I've got a couple of games on consignment right now. I've got a Chicago Cubs game.
Oh, cool.
It's on consignment. So I make a different arrangement for each client with consignment, but generally the goal with consignment is the seller gets more money than if they were to just sell it to a dealer. Because the dealer, like I said, is going to give them about half of what it's worth. I try and, you know, fix that. And I get back what I put into it plus some money for advertising and whatnot. So I have a Cubs game on consignment. That's a very popular title. I also have a Bears game on consignment, which I think is around, I think I have it priced at like $6,000, because it's one of probably less than 100 that were made. Stern did a run of NFL titles, and they took maybe 2,000 units. And divvied it up among all the franchises and said, you get X amount, you get X amount, you get X amount, and then that's what they manufactured. It's all the same game, it's just wrapped in different artwork. But for the Bears game, I think the estimate is that only about 150 of them are ever produced. And like I said, they won't go back and produce more. Mm-hmm. If they were to make another Bears game, it would be, you know, a totally different game. And I don't think they're going to make a Bears game.
No. At least not for a while.
Yeah, I don't think they'd even make a Cubs game. You know, it's...
Do you think that there will be a... like an arcade boom again?
Oh, there is already, yeah. It's the barcades. It's the adult arcades.
Gotcha.
It's definitely in the major metro areas.
Mm-hmm.
It is oriented towards adults, so you have to have it in a location that has some sort of nightlife. There was a recent barcade that opened up called Tokens and Tankards in Mount Prospect.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, well, they're gone.
Yeah.
Because Mount Prospect doesn't have a real active nightlife.
No. It would have done well
in the city.
In the city.
Yeah. Which is a shame. Or if he'd come up with a different business model for it, where it was oriented more towards, you know, I don't know. It's not my business, so I don't.
Yeah.
It's a shame that because I worked with Vince when he was opening it up.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a nice guy, but I think he was really tight on budget.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where. It's like anything, like a restaurant. You can't be tight on budget.
Yeah.
You have to have enough money to get through that lean year where people are still discovering you.
Yeah. Let's see. If you had a chance to sit down with one of your favorite game designers, what would you ask them?
Probably to explain how they think of the gameplay. You know, what is it in their head that makes them think to do this versus that? You know?
Okay.
Because that's the real we call it science or art behind a pinball machine is the gameplay. You know, how you position the objects. What the objects are valued at, stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot that goes into the rest of it too. But fundamentally, if you don't have a good playing game, it doesn't matter how cool the artwork looks.
Are there any fun stories that you've had within the industry?
Yeah, there's a lot.
You know. It's kind of a vague question.
I know. You know, like I said, my a lot of my business is in-home service.
Yeah.
So I get to visit a lot of people's houses. And there's some really cool houses out there. there's a house that technically I think it's Highland Park. Maybe it's Lake Forest. It's right off of Sheridan Road. It basically overlooks the lake. And you go down to their basement, and their basement is it's the part of the basement that I was in is basically a room, a good 40 feet long. All one side is windows that just look out over the lake. It's beautiful.
Nice. Very nice.
You know, another part of my business is customization. We have customized pinball machines, so we generally don't build something from scratch, but we will take an existing game, and we will retheme it for a particular brand. So I was contacted by a marketing company that was working for Wrigley to create pinball machines for them. I was contacted by the owners of the Sailor Jerry brand. To create Sailor Jerry themed pinball machines for them, and we've done custom games for Univision, and we have one or two that we might do next year. They tend to be big projects; they're fairly complicated. They don't come up very often, but I do have some pictures.
Cool.
I can dig that out if you want.
Oh,
it doesn't interview well. But custom back glass for Sailor Jerry.
Oh, nice. You mind if I take a picture of this?
No, go ahead. So it was, we took an existing game from the 60s and we completely rethemed it, which means that everything that was art related that you can see is themed towards Sailor Jerry, as opposed to this one is Royal Guard. This was a proof that we ran, so the score wheel windows are all blocked up, but otherwise they'd be clear. They provided the artwork. We don't do the artwork because it's all custom, okay. You know, with their brand. And it's got a swordfish in there, which is really cool.
Nice.
You can see him better. He's etched out, but what happens is during gameplay, when you light up certain lights, mm-hmm. it actually illuminates the swordfish, and you can see him in the artwork.
Oh, that's cool.
This one, we can't take pictures of, because okay. I signed something saying I wouldn't advertise that I did this.
Okay.
So I don't overly advertise it. I won't put it on my website or anything, but this is the game that we did for them. And again, totally rethemed. You know, this was a game from 78, 79, I think. They looked really cool. They ran three of these.
Oh, that's cool.
Sailor Jerry, we ended up with eight.
Okay.
And then this is the other type of work we do. This is the higher end restoration work. Mm-hmm. So you can see when we got the game in, that's what it looked like. And here's a close up of the play field.
Cool.
Somebody in the past had basically, what happened was the flippers, these are little 2-inch flippers down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. If they get misaligned, they start digging into the play field. So if they're not perpendicular to the play field, every time they scratch up the play field.
Okay.
So somebody had tried to cover up the scratches by painting this brown. And then they realized that to do that, they really needed to take that brown all the way around the baseline. Well, once you do that, you really need to paint the baselines in. So this is what they got to. I mean, you could just see this is hand painted by someone with not a lot of painting skills. So my guys basically sanded that stuff off. Recreated all the artwork, restored everything, put it all back together. So here's a close-up of the playfield when we were done. Clear-coated it with a matte finish. This is one of the pop bumper rings from this game. So basically, when you hit the skirt here, the way a pop bumper works is it comes down to kick the ball out. Mm-hmm. The legs aren't even the same size. So, screwed in, it's trying to do this every time. Now, clearly what they'd done is they'd re-welded that leg, and the fact that it was shorter didn't seem to bother them. They just tried to screw it all down. That's the kind of stuff we run across. And that's why Pat basically said, I don't do service on games that I didn't sell.
Yeah.
Because you never know what you're getting into. So from start to finish, we also redid the woodwork. I mean, there's the original woodwork.
Yeah.
You can see we sanded it down, we stained it, and then we polyurethaned it. But you can't see, the game has wooden legs. We did the same with the legs. So the wooden trim around the back box, the wooden trim around the play field, the lock bar at the front, and the legs all matched. So that's more of the work that we're doing now. Than the service work.
Okay.
Because these are bigger projects. They pay better.
Nice.
So when you recreate the artwork, you redraw everything? Like if it needs to be redrawn?
If it needs to be redrawn, we redraw it. I say we. I have guys that do that for me. I don't do that.
Okay.
I do very little of the restoration work, to be honest.
Nice.
So I do all the field service work. I mean, I've got a couple guys that work for me, that work in the shop or that, you know, do electronics or do paint or whatever. Mm-hmm. but I spend most of my days out doing service work. If I'm not, I'm here in the office and I need to do all the paperwork and the bills and drive out to Huntley to pick up parts and stuff like that.
And you mentioned you have a couple guys working for you. Are they friends or, you know, people that shared similar interests?
They're people that were interested in the pinball industry. Mm-hmm. They have their own businesses.
Okay.
That's part of the deal. I have no employees.
Okay.
That's a $4,000 insurance bill.
Yeah.
If you have one employee in the state of Illinois, you're required to have workman's comp, and you probably should have commercial liability. That's a couple grand a year. And then they audit your operation, and they find that you have other people working here that don't have workman's comp, and you're liable for it because you haven't run any claims, but you've exposed them to risk that they would otherwise not have.
Okay.
So all these guys here are generally one-man operations, just like me. So Midwest Pinball writes a check to, you know, Dan's Electronics Service, and that's it. It's just like hiring a plumber or writing a check to Home Depot.
Okay.
I have nothing to do with where that money goes. I don't have to do any 1099s. I don't have any unemployment. Yeah. I used to have an employee, and it almost buried the business, basically.
Oh, wow.
1 year. Yeah, 1 year I got hit by a, you know, $4,000 insurance bill in the middle of the summer, which is the slow season.
Yeah.
And quite honest, I don't make that kind of money. You know, if I've got $4,000, it's tied up in games somewhere. It's not sitting in the bank.
Yeah. Can you describe events that you showcase? If you showcase machines or
sure. The one show that we go to is the Chicagoland Coin Op Show. Okay. It's in St. Charles twice a year. They have a spring and a fall show. We bring games, we set up, we share a booth with our biggest competitor,
nice.
Who's also a business partner of mine. I mean, this industry is very small, on the pinball side, certainly. Yeah. The nice thing about that show is it's in a convention center with a big garage door in the back. It's intended that you sell stuff. So people walk around looking to buy stuff. They buy it. You break it down. You say, "I'll meet you. You know, I'll meet you in your car at the door. You pay me. We load it up into your truck. Goodbye."
Nice.
Yeah. I used to show at Pinball Expo, which takes place in a hotel ballroom. They have set up hours and teardown hours where you can use the service. Hallway mm-hmm. behind the ballroom. But if in the middle of the show you sell a game, they don't want you dragging the game through their service corridor because they're doing food service. And they certainly don't want you dragging it out the front door.
Yeah.
It's not oriented towards selling games. Mm-hmm. If you want to bring something to show and say, "Hey, look at all this work we did," which I've done that before too, that's great. But if I'm going to pay for a space, I'm going to pay for a space where I can sell something.
Yeah. And is there anything in particular that you showcase? Or
Typically, I do the older games.
Okay.
So like that guy back there from the 40s.
Nice.
Or 30s, actually. That's from the 30s. Fully restored. We'll do games from the 60s. My business partner has a lot of modern games. He tends to not deal with anything other than 90s and 2000s.
Okay.
And since he's letting me share the space with him, I don't want to sit there and put up games that are going to compete with his. Yeah. And generally, if somebody's if somebody's looking for, you know, an Addams Family or a Twilight Zone, they aren't going to be happy with a Golden Harvest, you know. And if somebody's looking for a Golden Harvest, they're not in the market for it, you know, for his games.
Yeah.
So there's, we don't conflict there.
Let's see. So have you ever designed your own machine?
No.
No?
Okay. No.
And, do you receive, a lot of donations, for machines or, you know, from older generations, or are they all looking to just sell and get out of Dodge?
Generally just sell it. Yeah. I don't get donations.
Okay.
We have donated stuff in the past. There were a couple of there was a charity event where they were looking for a pinball machine, and I had a machine that was functional, but it just wasn't a great game. Mm-hmm. But it was a pinball machine, so I gave it to them. Took the write off. There was a point at which I was getting into arcade games,
mm-hmm.
and I bought some arcade games from Sega.
Nice.
Out of GameWorks. So basically GameWorks contacted us and said, hey, we're refreshing all of the games in our Schaumburg location. We have a number of games that we don't need anymore. We'd be willing to sell. Do you want to come take a look? So I went and took a look. And they were cool games. A sit-down Star Wars game.
Nice.
You know, it's the Star Wars trilogy. You have all three combats in there. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. You know, but it's big. It's got a 50-inch monitor in it. What are you asking for it? $300. Basically, the only thing out of this game that we could use is that monitor, and I can get a new monitor for $300. So we'll sell it for $300. Well, how can I pass that up? I'll take this one and this one and this one and this one. That was a mistake. Yeah, I spent like $1,200.
Nice.
They sat in storage for years. Because every time someone would call, they'd say, hey, I see you have advertised this game. I want to, you know, put it in my basement. I'm like, oh, well, how do you get to your basement? Well, it's just a straight shot down the stairs. No stairs. The moment you say stairs, I say, no, I won't sell it to you. These games, you know, the sit-down Star Wars game, 50-inch monitor, speakers, platform, seat.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that comes apart on that, the seat comes off. The rest of it is a single piece. It's designed for an arcade. You know, the only way to put it in a home is, you know, to take out the patio doors and bring it through the patio doors or have it in a garage.
Yeah.
So these people would call me up and say, I'm interested in the game, and I'd say, I'd love to sell it to you, but I can't because it won't fit in your space. Well, can we try? No. Because then I'm a lot more money because, you know, you're going to buy it. We're going to take it to you. You're going to say, this doesn't fit. I want my money back. I'm going to have to take it back. I've just wasted a day. So I got a call from, there's a charity in Orland Park called The Garage. Mm-hmm. They are a garage that has been converted into a after-school youth space.
Nice.
They've got a stage. They've got, you know, a place to serve pizza and stuff. They've got a bunch of games. It's for some place kids can go after school to stay out of trouble. Sounds great. There you go. I need the storage space.
Yeah.
So, yeah, nobody calls me up and says, "Hey, we want to give you stuff." That's fine.
Nice.
If somebody wanted to go and play pinball machines, like, you know, where would you say they have like the best, they would have the best time to do that?
Probably one of the barcades, like Capitol or Emporium Arcade.
Okay.
Bar.
Okay.
If they're in Indiana, Twincades in Hammond, I think. Galloping Ghost has a ton of video games. They have a couple pinball machines that are buried deep somewhere in their location. Mm-hmm. But their location is really oriented more towards arcade games. But what's nice is you pay your $15 yeah. bucks, you get in, you've got the day to play all day.
Nice.
And you don't have to worry about age limits there, really. There is a site called, I think it's called Pinball Chicago, where you can look up where to play pinball in okay. Chicago.
Okay.
Somebody maintains that.
So do they have, like a machine like that, like an older one? No.
Nope.
You really can't play those anywhere.
That one in particular you can't play. Okay. Because it's a payout game. That one is a gambling device. and honestly, most kids aren't interested in playing anything that old. You know, pre-1949, it didn't have flippers. This game has no flippers. This game also didn't, as originally designed, run on electricity. It ran off of 1.5-volt batteries. But the way this works is you put your nickel in and you get 10 balls and you want to collect all of one type of vegetable and the harvest moon. The harvest moon is up here, so that's the shot you want to make. So if you make the harvest moon and get your two pumpkins, you get, you know, 15 cents back. So what it does is after you've played all your balls, it has an odds engine in it, which is the only thing in here that requires electricity because it has to calculate what you actually hit. There are no lights in this game. As I said, there's no flippers, there's no coils. There's nothing else in this game that runs off of electricity other than that odds engine.
Oh, okay.
That's your payout.
Oh, nice.
That's pretty neat.
It is, but it's clearly gambling, and this is what they had in mind in the 40s when they were banning pinball machines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is also a consignment game, and unfortunately, I'm not sure that it's ever going to sell because it's $4,000.
Oh wow!
Because we did the restoration on it, and I charged the guy about $2,800 for the restoration. So he's into it for about $32,000, and he's like, hey, I need $4,000 to make it worth it. I'm like, yeah, no kidding. Don't know what to tell you.
Is it okay if we take a picture of it?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, this is fine. Let me clear this stuff off.
Alright, cool.
It's a gorgeous game. It's a really interesting game. But if you think about something that you're going to have, you know, in your house for the kids to play.
Yeah.
And that was the problem was we did this. Tip it back a little bit.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
I'm so sorry about that.
No, that's fine. This office is a mess. And I didn't know you guys were coming. I really need to do some cleanup. He called me up. I don't know what it was. Couple months later, and he's like, hey, the kids aren't playing it. I'm like, well, if you had told me up front that you wanted the kids to play it, I would have told you not to bother. Your kids are not going to play this thing. But we had to do a lot of work to get it actually to work on wall power.
Oh, wow.
Because we can't, you can't put those, number one, nobody makes those batteries anymore. They stopped making them in the 70s. I looked it up. Number two, you wouldn't want to have batteries in a game like this because they're not very easily user changeable.
Yeah.
So when they die and start leaking acid, they destroy stuff. So we converted everything so that the engine works off of regular wall power. So you plug this in and it's like any other game. You plug it in. Right?
Cool.
Okay.
This is a fun project for us, unfortunately, that, you know, guys didn't play it.
Cool. pretty much all the questions we had.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.